I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Kansas City jazz scene lost one of its own yesterday with the passing of singer Kevin Mahogany. Today we'll speak with his sister and a fellow musician as we recall the world-renowned vocalist who recently had come back to Kansas City. Then we'll keep it right here close to home with a discussion about Kansas and Missouri wines. Master sommelier Doug Frost is back, and this time he's bringing solid gold vintages that won top awards at tasting competitions in 2017. From the rolling hills of Missouri to the prairies of Kansas, we'll take you through a few prize-winning bottles that represent the best of the heartland. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City lost jazz vocalist Kevin Mahogany over the weekend at age 59. Kevin had become one of the city's premier jazz exports, sharing his vocal talents with audiences worldwide. Joining us now to recall his life are Carmen Julius. She's Kevin Mahogany's sister. She joins us on the line from Columbia, South Carolina. And Carmen, know how sad so many of us are about your loss and how sorry we are.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that very much.
Clint Ashlock also joins us. He's a trumpeter and the artistic director for the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra. Clint, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Carmen, this took so many of us completely by surprise, I guess as these things often do. How unexpected was this?
Oh, it was very unexpected. We had just spoken with Kevin. He was excited about some projects he had coming up. He was preparing for an overseas trip where he had several performances scheduled. So, you know, we were all taken, you know, by surprise.
He had just moved back to Kansas City. Why had he come back?
Well, if you recall earlier this year in June, his wife, Aline, died. She died suddenly also. And they had been in preparation for making a move. They weren't exactly sure what they were going to do, but certainly moving to Kansas City was something that he had discussed with of course, with Aline, but also with the rest of the family. So I think that was his plan. When Aline died, he just felt like, you know, now was the time to do it. And so he just packed up and went back home. Kansas City has always been home. No matter where he's lived, he has always considered Kansas City home.
You know, Carmen, he's known here as one of Kansas City's great jazz exports to the wider world. I'm wondering, how much pride did he take in that?
Well, you know, I think Kevin was a very humble person. So, you know, when he was around us as family, he didn't, you know, talk about, oh, I'm Kevin Mahogany. I mean, he was just our brother. You know, he was just Kevin. But he took pride in his craft. He was, you know, just very passionate about it and passionate about sharing his expertise with others. He was very focused and committed to his craft and being the best he could be.
Clint Ashlock, you performed with him several times, including with Bobby Watson. What will you remember about him?
Well, you know, Kevin was one of the first jazz singers that I heard as a kid in person. And so going into those gigs, I mean, I came in as a fan, as somebody who had listened to Kevin, and then he had recorded with one of my teachers, Frank Mantooth, several times. And so I kind of looked at it as looking up to this figure who was a giant in the international jazz scene. So what I remember is just his extreme warmth, and that came across as a person as well immediately. As soon as you met him, he seemed very warm. And along with that warmth, there was this jubilant sound that,
yeah,
you know, was reminiscent of the past of Kansas City jazz music and the present. And you know, he was just an amazing force.
I mentioned he had become this international star, Clint, who traveled the world. That must have made him someone that other players looked up to when he was in town. Does that go without saying?
I think so. I think so. I mean, you know, in the jazz scene, there are people that are, you know, your buddies that just happen to be famous in a certain way, and then there are people that really seem to be kind of on another level of I guess the word would be stardom. And Kevin's stardom was, I mean, it loomed so large, you know, it seemed like to me. And I think whenever any of us got a chance to play with Kevin, it was a big deal. And I think that's for people that, you know, grew up kind of gigging with him in town too. Everybody spoke with of Kevin with this kind of reverence of what he had accomplished musically. But you know, when he sang, it was full of kind of this hominess and warmth and beauty that was really, really cool.
Carmen, what kind of brother was he?
Well, you know, he was my baby brother. He's the youngest of three. There are three of us. He was the youngest of three. So, you know, of course, you know, he was the baby brother. You know, you did stuff to him, but as he grew up, you know, he became very, you know, he was always very caring. He was the kind of person that would do anything for you at any time, whatever you needed. He would figure out a way and find out a way to do it. And you know, it was just a family person. You know, we call each other any time of day or night. He'd be halfway across the country, and it was daytime for me. I'd call him, and it was the middle of the night wherever he was. And even though he was up late, you know, sometimes he'd be very tired, but he would always take time to talk with us, and he would always make sure that he sent my son some token from whatever country he was in, so that he would have some, you know, memorabilia from whatever country Kevin was traveling in. Of course, then he was very devoted to his wife, and you know, his marriage meant a lot to him. So I think he was just a really good family person, and just, you know, somebody that we are going to very much miss. A part of our family is just gone.
As a kid, Carmen, do you remember him singing around the house? Did he do that when you were young?
Well, you know, when we were young, he started out as an instrumentalist. We all did. Mom insisted on music lessons, so we played piano, we played instruments. We'd always make our little bands in the house and, you know, compete against each other about, you know, who could play a piece best and all those kinds of things. He was in dance school, as we all were, you know, took dance and tap and all those kinds of things. So, you know, he really grew up as an instrumentalist. Even through high school, he played sax in the Lincoln High School band, you know, and played in a couple of jazz ensembles. We used to hang out a lot at the Charlie Parker Foundation, and after a while, Kevin used to actually teach lessons there. Even though he was still in high school, he taught some of the younger kids music lessons, and you know, really kind of got close to Eddie Baker there, and you know, performed with him even, you know, as a young kid, again on the sax. It wasn't until after college, even through college, I think he played in a jazz ensemble, played sax in a jazz ensemble. But after college, he played with a couple of bands, got up a couple of bands together. Still started out as a sax player, as an instrumentalist, but at some point early on, he you know, became the vocalist and just put down that sax, and he really never picked it back up. A lot of times when we'd be out and about, maybe at performances or in places where people would recognize him, they would say something to him about playing the sax, and he was like, "Oh no, I've put that sax down. I've not picked one up in years." And he never played it again. Once he became a vocalist, I think he just fell in love with it and, you know, just went from there.
Well, that's Carmen Julius, the sister of Kevin Mahogany, remembering the life of the great jazz singer Kevin Mahogany. Carmen, thanks for your time, and again, our condolences.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you having me here today. I appreciate this tribute to Kevin.
Clint Ashlock, we appreciate your time too.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll go out with Kevin Mahogany singing Ruby My Dear from his 2005 album, Kevin Mahogany Big Band.
came and made music play in his way. You say you'd rather die than say goodbye, but there'll come a day, though he's away. Carry on, Ruby, my dear.
Well, it wasn't that many years ago when wines from Kansas and Missouri weren't given much more attention than a ho-hum from enthusiasts. Not anymore. Doug Frost, a master of wine and master sommelier, in fact, he's just one of four in the world with those dual titles, has been raving about what Kansas and Missouri vineyards have been kicking out for years now, and today he'll give us an update. A visit from Doug is something of an up-to-date tradition around the holidays, and Doug, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you. Very nice to be back.
So just how quickly have wineries in Kansas and Missouri come on the scene? Because it wasn't that many years ago that there wasn't much of a wine industry here at all, right?
Well, it's true in the main. I mean, if you go back a century or so, Missouri was a very robust wine community. Even Kansas, if you go back a century and a half ago, was quite a robust wine producer. But that all changed, and that's, you know, in the distant past. So really what people have been up to over the last 20 years or so, I'd say 25 years, is honing their craft, getting better with grapes, specific grapes, figuring out which grapes work here.
I was going to say, obviously, a new generation has come on the scene, and they're figuring this out, you're saying.
Yeah, very much so. The second generation of a sort. First generation being the people of the 60s and 70s who tried to resurrect the wine industries here. Their children have come along and they study wine and they know about wine around the world and they, you know, demand of their own wines that they stand up to wines of the world. So I think the second generation has really been the leaders and have helped bring Kansas and Missouri wines and frankly, these days, Nebraska and Iowa and wines from other states that we certainly didn't think of as being wine producers have brought them really to modernity, to high-quality wines.
Well, are people on the coast, those snobby folks on the East Coast and the West Coast, are they willing to consider wines here in the Heartland as something they'll imbibe in? Are sales suggesting that there's that kind of acceptance?
In general, we drink our own wines, and they drink their wines, or you know, wines that they've heard of, and there isn't a great deal of commercial curiosity about wines made off the coasts. Californians tend to drink their own wine, and I don't think there's anything necessarily.
They've always been that way.
I know
there,
there's nothing wrong with it. Yeah. I mean, in a way, really, it's about people drinking local produce, and much as we try to enjoy local produce in the grocery stores and in the restaurants, what I will say is that if you want to perk up a California winemaker, in fact, I just got back from a conference in California, and I was hanging out with 40 winemakers, and their greatest curiosity is, what did you bring us from Missouri? What did you bring us from Iowa? Yeah. They're dying to taste these things. And in fact, we're sort of demanding, like, you only brought six. Why did you only bring six wines? I'm like, it's easier to drag those on the plane. Come on, guys, help me out here.
Yeah.
You know? So I think there's a great deal of curiosity about it, and there's a certain sense of novelty to it. And steakhouses like Smith & Wolensky or there's other places in D.C. have sometimes tried to focus on wines from all over the country. But again, it's a novelty. And so I would say we have to take care of our own. We really have to drink our own wine, show interest in our own wineries if we want them to improve and to know which wines are good and which wines are less good. Having said that, certain wineries like Stonehill have done a very good job of getting outside the Missouri marketplace.
And we'll talk about Stonehill. So when the snobs from the coast drink our wines, what kind of reactions are you seeing?
Usually surprise. It's that pleasant surprise of, wow, this is really good. You know, it's like, I tried to tell you, you know.
Yeah, you weren't listening to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, for you, who's been, you know, covering the industry and so deeply invested in it for so many years, this has got to be kind of a kick that you're seeing right here in your backyard, these vineyards taking off here.
It's certainly great to see this curiosity and this interest. I think the diversity of grapes is what I find most encouraging. I would admit that the industry here is still small enough that I sometimes feel like we're sort of lurching from grape to grape and style to style instead of someone sitting down in a style and saying, this is what I represent, this is what I'm going to do, and I don't care what the marketplace does, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. Instead, a lot of times you see people saying, oh, this week's grape is Traminette, and I love Traminette, but it's like, you know, does everybody need to make a Traminette and suddenly start ripping out their Sauvignon Blanc? I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, give us a little list here. Which wineries from Kansas and Missouri should wine enthusiasts from who are listening here be aware of here?
Well, I think the fun thing is that you can do, you know, day trips and you can visit wineries in the area. And that wasn't as true 10 years ago and 20 years ago. Now we really do have a lot of folks in the area. So as a matter of fact, that's funny. I was just my accountant just yesterday was like, oh, I got to get out of here early. I'm going out to Holyfield. I was like, cool, that'll be fun. Holyfield's, you know, a quick short drive. But Pirtle isn't that far away either. And Pirtle has been very successful the last couple of years. They've actually, over the last 3 years, won a couple of different Jefferson Cups, which are the top award we give at this competition for their Blackberry Mead. Mead is not, I know, a wine, but we also judge that within a lot of wine competitions.
What is a mead?
Basically, it's a honey wine, people will call it, but it's a fermented beverage made from honey, and it goes back thousands and thousands of years because humans being what humans are, we'll make alcohol out of whatever we can find. and mead is actually really fascinating. You know, if you have enough honey and water it down basically and let the yeast get to it, you can convert that into a fascinating and even complex alcohol beverage. And Pirtle makes this blackberry mead, and I sort of roll my eyes because it's like we've given the same mead the Jefferson Cup twice, but it's really good. Mm. So why shouldn't we?
Well, what did you bring with us today? Because we have a couple of tasters who have, we had to drag them in here. They were so reluctant to come in the door. Danny Alexander, our producer for Up to Date, and Steven Steigman, the founding producer of Up to Date, are both sitting side by side with Doug Frost here.
Ooh, the band's back together.
Short reunion tour.
Yeah.
for the next 40 minutes.
Well, I thought I'd bring some wines that have done well at the Jefferson Cup over the years, and certainly just some wines that I think are notable in the area. And throughout Missouri. This is Noble Ice Dry Vignol. And Dry Vignol is a style that really didn't even exist 5 or 10 years ago. Vignol as a grape is relatively new in this area, even though it's not that young a grape, but it got here, you know, only about a decade ago or so. And the easy thing to do with it initially was to make it into a sweet wine. That worked out really, really well. It just, because of its sort of complications in the vineyard, it was easier to make it into a sweet wine. People making it into a dry wine, you had to do a little work with it out in the vineyard and get it to ripen more evenly. And so now suddenly there are these choices of Dry Vignol out there. And I think it's great. I think Noble Ice does this really nice version, sort of peachy pear kind of flavors.
Yeah, I was going to say it's dry, but it's not killer dry.
No, I was going to say the same thing. I'm not a huge fan of really dry wine.
Yeah.
This is a really a nice balance between dry and sweet. This works for me.
And you do taste a little pear in here, and what else?
I'm not tasting it yet, but I don't have the most sophisticated of wine palates.
I'll teach you about it later.
Yeah, thank you.
Everyone knows how sophisticated my palate is, yeah.
I think this has a nice tart finish.
Yes,
and
it does.
I really like that. I mean, this is, it doesn't cloy on your tongue. It does leave you refreshed in the mouth. So it's clean. It's and I prefer a dry. I'm not an overly sweet. Unless it's as dessert, I might go with a sweeter wine. But when I discovered this grape several years ago, it's like always in my wine rack.
I was expecting it to be a bit more dry just based on the nose. But
the balance is really
nice.
It
really is, yeah.
And it doesn't cloy on your tongue. That's a verb. That's an impressive verb coming from a producer of the show. Just for the record.
Give her some credit.
That's right. It's a very important term. It's one of those things that we seek after in wine. We talk all the time about balance. And if something is cloying, then I think we all agree it's not balanced. But the question is, I guess I would put it this way, that balance is absolutely subjective. But what I do think balance could be defined as being is something that reminds me of an old Irish whiskey term, which is if you ask an old Irish whiskey distiller, you know, what are you looking for in your Irish whiskey? You say, I want it to be a bit marish. And it's like, mm-hmm. Marsh is not Northern Africa. What they want is they want you to need to drink more every time you drink it. And the idea there is
good
that,
marketing, huh?
Yeah. Well, and the idea there is that it's satisfying, but not completely satisfying. Sure. There's always a little something left there that makes you go, better have another little taste
of
that.
Was it Noble Ice Vignoli that took... Didn't they have an award winner this year?
Actually, last year they...
Was it last year?
Yeah,
okay.
Last year they... But they do extremely well in the Missouri Wine Competition, and I just think they make a really solid dry vignole. And it has that little tight, little tart thing right at the end that makes it not cloying.
Makes your mouth water.
And makes it Moorish.
Huh. We're talking Kansas and Missouri wine with Master Sommelier Doug Frost. And if our listeners have questions as they move into the holiday season here, full tilt, we have a great expert here who can answer those questions. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, let's talk about some of the vineyards and the wineries you just mentioned, Doug. And let's start with Stone Hill over in Herman. That took the Triple Crown at this year's Missouri Wine Competition. Tell us about Stone Hill.
Well, they've been around for a long,
yes,
long time.
Yes, they're kind of the venerable...
They really are, yeah. They're the grand old dame of Missouri wine, I think. The winery itself and the location and, indeed, a winery business dates back to the mid-19th century, back when Missouri was really an important producer within the U.S. wine industry. In Stone Hill, that facility was there at the time, and the restaurant there, if you go out and visit it there in Herman, is really fun to visit. There's good food there. It's a cool place to visit. They make remarkable wines, and they are one of those wineries that when I bring things out to California or to New York to winemakers there, the first response is, oh, yeah, I know Stone Hill. You know, they're like, oh, no, I got that. Show me something I don't know.
The 2015 Norton was supposed to be one of their better products. Is that where we are?
Yeah, their Nortons are delicious. I brought along, actually, the Cross J, which is the single vineyard top Norton that they make. I brought a 2012 because I thought I'd bring something with a little time to it. And I think the Cross J Norton is as good as Norton needs to be. Now, Norton is not everybody's grape, and when we taste it, but it seems to be Danny's grape. She's waving me over. But right now, you know, that's the red. We'll do that last because that's kind of intense. Right now, what I thought we'd open is the Augusta Vidal Blanc, and Vidal Blanc is another grape that's relatively new here. It's been worked for about 20 years or so. And once again, following in the footsteps of Vignol early on, worked really well as a delicious sweet wine. In fact, if you go up to the Niagara Escarpment, absolutely delicious ice wines are made out of Vidal Blanc up in Canada. But we're making these drier styles or off-dry styles, and I think we do a really good job with it. This is Augusta.
You're describing that exactly as I was tasting it. It was first a very mild, yet sweet. I'm like, this reminds me of something. And you mentioned ice wine, but a drier version of it. And it's not as sweet. So I found it a little, certainly much milder than our previous selection, but still really, really pleasant wine.
Yeah. Yeah, pleasant's a great word for it.
Apricot,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Something like that, a little apple.
Yes, I taste the apricot.
I think a little more toward that kind of fruit rather than the citrus that the previous one had.
Smooth finish, too.
Yeah, very smooth.
No acidity on the back end.
Nope, none at all. It's
Wow. No acidity on the back. This is, you've been listening to
I totally
some
pulled that out of someplace.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what you're doing here.
Well, I do like some acidity. I mean, I think it does kind of finish clean. But to your point, it doesn't finish with that Kerwang.
Right.
And the Noble Ice does kind of have a bit of a Kerwang.
That's
a new term.
I don't know.
Is
what
with
else
a K
you call
or with a
it?
C?
Look that word up for me, would you please?
I'm thinking K.
This is from the Augusta Winery from Augusta, Missouri, which is where?
Well, you have to go all the way over to the east side of the state, and it's just, you know, not too far off Highway 70, not far at all, you know, 40-minute drive from St. Louis. Augusta and Montel are both managed by the same winemaker, a guy named Tony Kuyumjin. And if Stone Hill is the grand old dame, I think Tony Kuyumjin is arguably the best winemaker in Missouri, if it's not David Johnson at Stone Hill. And for many people, I think Tony Kuyumjin is one of the best winemakers in America, period, end of story. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that to be true. And I love the stuff he makes.
That's an incredibly drinkable wine. Like, I could find myself going through that glass a little bit too quickly, not really recognizing that it was wine.
This is what I call a deck wine. This is a wine I'd want out on the deck down at the lake house, definitely. The whole bottle.
Steve,
and
what
an
did
evening.
That fits a whole lot of categories
friends.
With you, Danny, just for the record. A whole lot of of deck wines that might work really there. I'm not even going to try to compete with how you guys are describing these wines. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our tour of some terrific Missouri and Kansas wines with Doug Frost. We'll take your questions at 816-235-2888. If you're wondering what to serve with your turkey or ham this holiday season, or maybe it can be beer. Doug's recommended that before. Give us a shout, 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we found out why recent ousters at the Missouri State Board of Education have lawmakers on both sides of the aisle worried about politics sneaking into education policy. If you missed that conversation, listen to it at kcur.org. Tomorrow, we take a look back on an eventful year, and we'll discuss the media's role in it. We'll chat about which stories got comprehensive coverage and which ones got ignored. It's a conversation with our media critics tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, about some award-winning wines from Missouri and Kansas. People don't think of us as being a hot spot for wines, and Doug thinks maybe that's beginning to change out there. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Mike from Leawood. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you guys?
Well, thanks.
Good. I was wondering if Doug has a recommendation of a port wine that may be produced in this area.
Yeah, absolutely. The Norton grape has been really, really handy at making port and providing people with a good basis for port. So Holyfield, Stonehill, St. James, Le Bourgeois, I think Jowler Creek does one as well. They're all really solid because Norton just likes to be port. I don't quite know why that is, but it's one of those grapes that just really enjoys being made into port.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Mike.
Yeah. Okay. Let's scoot on to another winery here that you want to talk about, Doug. Let's go back to Holyfield Winery on the Kansas side, which we visited this summer here on Up to Date. It's in Basser, Kansas, and remind us why this vineyard is as notable as it is.
Well, they have, I think, single-handedly altered the landscape in Kansas. It's
wow.
A winery that over the last quarter century, you know, they've learned along the way like everybody else, but they've made really good choices. Michelle and her dad are just really dedicated to that land. They're dedicated to this proposition of getting better and better with these grapes, and they've helped launch other wineries. They've helped other people, you know, so it's not just Holyfield in Kansas anymore. There's Blue Jacket and Somerset Ridge does great stuff, another great place to visit. There's a lot of good things going on, Stone Pillar, et cetera, yeah, you know, on the Kansas side. And I think that at least for this palate, Michelle and her dad at Holyfield have led the way. They won a Jefferson Cup this year for a Traminette that they make that was just, you know, wildly floral and nice and clean and crisp at the finish.
You know, how tricky is it to launch a vineyard from scratch in Missouri or Kansas? Is it tougher here than it is in California or out east somewhere?
I would say that it's more difficult here to grow grapes to make good wine than it is in California. In California, it's a climate that helps you grow grapes. And best of all, you're growing grapes that many people are familiar with. It's much easier to grow Chardonnay and Cabernet there, and certainly by a great measure, than it is to do so here. At the same time, however, the Missouri Department of Agriculture is incredibly progressive and proactive in helping people get established right, helping them understand what they should do and where they should do it and how they should do it. And marketing Missouri wines is not a huge challenge. On the Kansas side, you get less support, but land is less expensive than it is in California, so it's a mixed bag.
I was going to ask about the barriers to entry in Kansas and Missouri versus California. You hear about plenty of chefs who come to the Midwest to open up restaurants because the costs are lower up front, but I did not really think about that the types, the varieties of grapes you plant are up there, maybe offsetting the cost of land, etc. I kind of a follow-up question. Sorry to steal the show from you, Steve.
It wouldn't be the first time.
Except, well... Well, then I'll go on and ask my question. What role does wine tourism play in Kansas and Missouri? Because it does for a large part in New York and in California. Is it taking off, or is it? I mean, we've been flyover country for such a long time, and people are now beginning to notice this area. Is the same thing happening for wine?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. However, Missouri residents and visitors to friends in Missouri or Kansas or Iowa, Nebraska, or what have you, that really makes the difference. Those are the people that are walking into the tasting rooms for these wineries and such. So I think once again we're sort of on our own in all this, but it's having a big impact. And for me, the impact was always obvious in so much as most of the wineries for a long time were close to St. Louis. And so St. Louis had a great awareness of Missouri wine. They sold and drank more Missouri wine than we did in Kansas City. And as the Kansas City side of things has grown, that has changed. And we've seen more awareness and more acceptance of the wines here.
Okay. Well, Steve, you can have your show back now.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Chris Knowles wrote us this on Twitter. What are your thoughts on major wines, the Gamay Noir, local connection, limited release, very drinkable? She says, you know what Chris is talking about?
Well, I certainly love the Gamay grape. I'm not sure when she said major wines. I'm not precisely sure if that's a brand that she's referencing or what have you. The question would be, you know, how is Gamay itself doing? And it's a grape that is finally getting its due, particularly that Beaujolais, its home turf in France, was not so long ago referred to as merde, and they got sued, you know, the writer for saying that, and it was like one of those, why don't you just make the wines better? And they are. The wines are fantastic now. Well, so there are people like Ayers in Oregon, who's a guy originally from Kansas City, who's now growing Gamay Noir in Oregon and making, I think, a really delicious version. So there's some interest and attention now to the grape, and it's well-deserved.
And Carrie emailed us this, Doug. Do you have any information about the wine produced from the Vale Estate in Independence, Missouri, back in the 1880s?
Oh, no, I really don't know. It's one of those stories I need to pursue.
Okay.
And so I've never really known about that for sure.
I'll help.
Yeah. Danny's like, let's do research. Yay.
Yeah.
Let's go to Melissa from Olathe. Melissa, you're on Up to Date with Doug Frost. We're talking Missouri and Kansas wine. Good morning.
Good morning. We're having guests from out of town, and we're going to serve barbecue. What can we pair with great Kansas City barbecue?
Well, the sort of
great question.
Knee-jerk response is Norton, you know, and I love to pronounce it like that, Norton, because it is kind of a rough and tumble Ralph Cramden.
I was going to say that's how Jackie Gleason used to say it. Yeah,
it's a little like Ralph Cramden. However, I think Chamberson is a grape that appeals to a broader palate. That's to say, a broader section of palates, a cross-section of palates. And Chamberson, once again, Augusta, Montel, they make delicious Chamberson.
Holyfield, I like theirs when we had the tasting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Holyfield makes a lovely one, and Stonehill makes great Chamberson. Honestly, if you find a nice Chamberson in the local stores, and you should, there should be at least four or five choices there, go ahead and pair that up with barbecue. It'll do great.
Chamberson. Got that, Melissa?
It's a red wine,
love
red
it.
Grape,
yes,
kind
you.
Of raspberry flavored, almost like a Merlot with Syrah blended in.
If you could, you can invite us too, Melissa.
Come on over.
Okay, we'll be there. Thanks. Happy holidays, Melissa and Mike from Overland Park. Mike, you're on Up to Date.
My wife and I really like a style of German wine called the Gewürztraminer, and I was kind of curious if there's any Kansas or Missouri equivalent of that, or something very similar to it.
What is the Gewürztraminer? Help me there.
Yeah, Gewürztraminer is a
bless you.
Basically means the spicy Traminer. It probably originates in northern Italy, and then migrates to France. It's also grown as Mike's saying in Germany and Austria, and it has a wonderfully spicy floral kind of aroma to it. It can be fairly heady, fairly big, fairly bold, depending upon where it's grown. And Alsace is without question the place where it really shines and becomes this incredibly powerful white wine. Here in Missouri, we have a couple of grapes, one called Traminette, and Gewürztraminer, as you can tell from the name, is one of the parents of that grape. And I would say, Mike, that it's not the same as Gewürztraminer. It's lighter, it's more floral, it's a lot crisper than that. So it may not satisfy you quite the same way a Gewürz would. But if you're ready for, you know, a much lighter and slightly more floral version of it, that will work. Or Valvin Muscat, Les Bourgeois makes a fantastic Valvin Muscat. And that's from the Muscat grape, which is a similar grape, wildly floral, usually made, or at least once upon a time, usually made dry. Nowadays, we find it sweet, sparkling, everything all over the board.
We've been doing the show for years, and I'm hearing words today I've never heard before. Govert's demeanor. Mike, I hope that helped. Yeah, thanks. You just poured yet another glass here, Doug. This is the first red you've poured here today, and this is as dry as the Sahara Desert. This is one dry wine. Yes, it is.
No, you think of reds as being more like Pinot Noirs or a Malbec maybe, but no, this is, wait, turn that bottle back around again, because I want to see the, this is the one that has the great story to it, but I like this. It's reds for me will always have over whites the nose. I could just leave my nose in the glass and never drink a red. I just love the nose of a red, but this has not too much tannin.
It has
not too much tannin.
It has too much tannin for Steve.
It does for Steve, but not for me. I mean, if your tongue's not sticking to the roof of your mouth, Steve, there's not too much tannin.
But I value Steve's opinion on this. If this wine tastes dry to him, then this is a dry wine for him, and he should choose something that's not so dry.
Well, that's the whole thing. We all have different palates. We all have different sensitivities.
That's true.
And it has nothing to do with education, because people always do that. You're a very educated palate. It's like, that's nonsense.
Right.
What does your body want you to consume? Mm-hmm. And your body, I'm hypersensitive bitter, so when Steve says, wow, that's super dry, I'm like, yeah, it is, But I've grown accustomed to that, and I'm okay with that. I couldn't drink coffee till I was like 30 years old, and then I realized, you just dump some milk in there, have it as an espresso, so it's over really quickly, and that is the best feeling ever, So it's we all have different sensitivities, and we're not supposed to like the same wines.
So this is
crazy stuff. I thought it'd be fun to bring. There's a charity that I try to assist called Angel Flight Central that provides free transportation to people in need via pilots using their own planes, and Angel Flight pays for their gas and food and lodging and things like that. And so one of the competitions that I've referenced here, the Jefferson Cup, the proceeds that we create go to Angel Flight Central, just trying to help in any way we can. So last year we actually auctioned off the chance to make wine, and a local supporter of Angel Flight flew with three of her friends to Washington State to Camaraderie Cellars, which has been kind of a perennial favorite at the Jeff Cup, and make their own wine. They started with 25 barrels of wine, and they selected the ones they wanted. They blended them together, and they ended up with 2 barrels of wine, which makes about 50 cases of wine. And we bought it, and we brought it here and poured it at the annual fundraiser, and that's the wine you're drinking right now. And it's actually in town. Gomer's sells it, Underdog, a few other places like that. It's a Malbec, interestingly. It's Malbec and blended with Tempranillo, then with a little bit of Cabernet Franc, a little Cabernet.
A lot of my favorite grapes.
It's a great blend.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's a lovely blend. And it's good for a good cause. I love drinking for charity.
Doug Frost is here. He's one of 4 people on the planet who's a master of wine, master sommelier. It used to be 3 people on the planet. Now it's 4.
Yes.
You're getting some competition out there, Doug.
It's okay. I love it.
If our listeners want to join our conversation with some questions about which wines to pick for which meals, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for another great show.
Great. Thanks, Kevin.
Absolutely. I have wanted for years to support a local Missouri, specifically winery, but it seems like they are all horribly German-based, which is, all well and good, except if one wants to drink a dry white wine. And I know you mentioned one earlier that had sounded like a tremendously French name, and I may be mistaken on that. But anyway, you said it was kind of dry with a maybe sweet finish or something like that. I have not been able to find, something along the lines of, say, a Chardonnay or something that's truly nice and rich and full-bodied and dry and smooth. Is there anything out there?
For sure. Now, I definitely, I get where you're coming from on this, Kevin. The thing about the grapes that we grow in this part of the country is that they tend to have really high acidity. So if you make a completely bone dry white wine in this area, typically it's way too dry for most folks. It's super tart. far more tart than any wine you would find in California, in honesty. So the way people have dealt with it as winemakers is they've always left a little sugar in there, just enough to soften the palate so it's not so aggressively tart in the finish. It's been a learning curve trying to figure out how to, how to keep pushing that a little bit closer and closer to something that is as you say, that starts dry, finishes dry. I say Les Bourgeois is a good winery to consider, and they're outside of Colombia. But I think any of these wineries, Augusta, Stonehill, Montel, Holyfield, Amigoni makes certainly dry wines here in town. Any of those people, if you tell them exactly what you're looking for and tell them, look, I know that you have some wines that you describe as dry, like this Dry Vignol from Noble Ice. It's described as dry. It's labeled as dry. It's not completely dry. It's a little bit sweet in the finish. And so you're really going to have to put them to the task of being completely honest with you and saying, I need something that's bone dry. If you don't have that, just tell me and I'll move on. But right. Every year people are trying to do that. So know that's a goal that these winemakers are trying to attain.
Okay. Well, thanks. It's I'm sorry there's not a good, strong answer out there, but at least I know. Now I'll head for Les Bourgeois.
Yeah, give that a try. See what you think.
Thank you.
Good luck, Kevin. Thank you. Let's go to Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, you're on Up to Date with Doug Frost. Good morning.
Hey, thanks. You know, I have listened to you for the last half hour, and you haven't mentioned the St. James Winery yet, which is been around, as far as I know, as long as Stonehill has, and is a really great winery. I love it. In fact, a few years back, I tasted a Chamberson that they had, and lots of times Chamberson will have like a little aftertaste to it or some like a little acid in the end of it, but this one was perfect. They figured out a way to make this that just made it just roll off your tongue like velvet. I was really impressed with it.
Yeah, listen, there's over 100 wineries here, so I always feel badly.
100 wineries in both Kansas and Missouri?
Well, no, 100. There's over 100 wineries in Missouri alone.
Wow,
130 the last I checked.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a ton of them.
But back to St. James. St. James is either the largest or the second largest winery in Missouri. So your point, Mike, it shouldn't be left out. And they've been around a long time. I love those people. They're really, the Hoffers are really cool people, and they've built a fantastic business, obviously, because most of the time when I tell people that the size of St. James, I mean, they're around 300,000 cases. I tell people that in California, they freak out. They're like, how is that even possible? I'm like, we drink our wine here, okay?
Wow. I hope that helps, Mike. Thank you.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, how does a winery know when its wine is good enough to enter in competitions?
Well, the only way they know is by entering a competition, unfortunately.
You find out.
And there are some wineries I come into contact with a lot of different people who just say, I don't need it anymore. I've won a few medals. I'm good. Or people don't get my wines. I've actually had that happen in some cases where people say, look, I've entered your competitions a few times and I don't get anything. I'm like, I just don't think your style is conducive to the judges. You might as well try a different competition. And I'll point them to other competitions.
Well,
to see if they
that
can
leads
have
me to a question that I've been meaning to ask. Is there a standard? I mean, like in a lot of things, there's a standard to which the entry must. And does that perhaps limit people that are not necessarily bottling wines to that standard? In other words, that individual, I'm doing my own thing kind of? And does that kind of hinder them?
It's not specific in any way because every judge brings their own standard with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you select judges and then every judge is on a panel. And the idea is that they, have to talk to each other and it may create a compromise that allows more wines to be embraced and accepted. At the same time, sometimes you end up with a panel of judges that just seem to want to hate everything. And it's kind of odd, as somebody who runs these competitions and judges as well in other competitions, it's all chemistry, the chemistry of human beings and what kind of mood they're in. So when people say, wow, competitions are not consistent, I'm like, well, no, neither are human beings and neither is a bottle of
wine.
It's not that it's random. It's just that if somebody in a competition says, I found a wine that's utterly delicious, pay attention. It probably is.
How important are these competitions? Because certainly advice from wine experts to vineyards is really important.
Mm-hmm.
But there must be other ways of a vineyard finding out, that's working or no, that's not working.
But I would think also, though, Stephen, that just for to get a foot up, I mean, it's got to be a good thing to be able to say, hey, I won Jefferson Cup. seriously, when you think about it.
Bragging rights is sort of the key to all this, isn't it, Doug? I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, when people walk into a tasting room, you'll see trophies and medals and that sort of thing because people want you to know that, if you will, a third party has endorsed this wine, has enjoyed this wine. There are many ways to marketplace wine writers, reviews, and sometimes just having, you know, connections and friendships with big retailers or restaurateurs can have that impact. So there's all sorts of ways to market, but a competition is one way when you don't know anybody to join in, and it's worked. It works for wineries often, at least for a time.
So, last question. What do the first 25 wineries in Missouri think about the other 105 competitors? Are they thinking, oh my gosh, my market share is going to shrink, or do they like competition?
Obviously, there are different attitudes about it all, but I certainly am one of those that believes the rising tide lifts all boats, that creating greater attention and competing against each other, you know, making each other make better wine, that's good for the industry.
Bianca from south of Lawrence, you're on with Doug Frost. We're talking Kansas and Missouri wines. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a winery right down the road from me, a small one, and its name's Kugler Vineyards.
And Doug's nodding his head, Bianca.
He knows it, yes or no?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so I just wanted to put a shout out for Kvyat and Tony Kugler.
Yeah, and actually they've been around for quite a while. I don't recall quite when they started, but they've been around for well over a decade. And, you know, it's all I can say is it's really fun to go visit folks like the Kublers, and it's really fun to go visit wineries in general. Now, I should point out the last wine, the Norton.
Oh, yes. Gosh, this is
by
good.
The way, sorry to yeah. jump off subject real quick, but this is the Cross J Norton from Stonehill, and it's one of those, I don't have enough of this in my basement. Let's put it that way.
Really,
you got to have something
really,
out of
the nose on this is
I know. It's got that little, and I always think of it as, and it's going to sound very off-putting, and I don't mean it to be, but it just like the faintest hint of tar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's Norton. Interesting. Norton is not an elegant fella.
You know, as a master of wine and a master sommelier, how close can you come to identifying, you know, the origin, the grapes, and the vintage of a wine when you take a sip?
Well, we're supposed to be able to do that, but only with classic wines, and that's to say only with classic versions of those wines. Anybody can make a wine that tastes like it comes from someplace else, even though it'll be kind of a mess. What winemakers usually seek to do is make a wine that tastes unique to the place. And in so doing, they're making a wine that no one else can really imitate, and that wine becomes theoretically something worthy of somebody's dollar.
Well, Doug, always great to have you here. We're out of time. It wouldn't be the holidays without you. Thanks so much for taking the time to come in.
Yeah.
Stephen Steigman, Danny Alexander, thank you for your expertise.
No, thank you.
On
thank
all
you.
The, all the sipping going on here.
Indeed.
For those awaiting next month's big reveal of the Oscar nominees, my conversation with the film critics last Friday is a must-listen. You can find it at kcur.org. Tomorrow, I'll look back at the media in 2017. It was a very busy year in news and current events. The media critics and I will check out how well they were covered. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.